540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper. On the fifth day of their humanitarian ceasefire, Israel and Hamas free more hostages and prisoners. CBS's Lilia Luciano reports from Tel Aviv on the effort to extend the ceasefire again.
Right now, we know that today the director of the CIA, Bill Burns, was in Doha, part of these negotiations. Secretary of State Blinken is going to be here in Tel Aviv, in the West Bank, and in the UAE to continue negotiating. So those efforts are still being made. But for now, no changes have been made beyond 10 hostages for every day of a ceasefire and three Palestinian prisoners. Up until now, it's been women and children for every Israeli hostage released.
Pentagon Press Secretary Brigadier General Pat Ryder says there have been no attacks on U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria since the pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas began on Friday.
Our forces are there for one reason, and that's to stay focused on the defeat ISIS mission. And so we will continue to focus on that mission, as well as ensuring that our forces are protected should there be any additional attacks.
It was a packed house to remember the life of former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. Former President Jimmy Carter, at 99 years old, left hospice care to attend the service. Daughter Amy Carter spoke during the service at the Glenn Memorial Church in Atlanta.
My mom spent most of her life in love with my dad. Their partnership and love story was a defining feature of her life.
Rosalynn Carter's private funeral is tomorrow. Lawmakers could vote this week on whether to remove Representative George Santos from Congress after the Ethics Committee this month said the New York Republican is guilty of corruption and fraud. CBS's Scott McFarlane.
The clock began ticking middle of the afternoon today. One of the House members went to the floor, in fact, two of them did, to invoke a parliamentary technique which provides for a 48-hour window for the House to move on this expulsion vote. It's rarely used, but it was used today, requiring there either be a vote on expulsion, likely sometime Thursday.
A South Carolina woman is dead after falling through the floor of her home and then into a well. CBS's Matt Piper has the bizarre story.
83-year-old Dorothy Downey died when she fell through rotting floorboards in a century-old South Carolina house and down a well shaft that no one knew was there. The fall below was 48 feet deep. Scott Crane is Oconee County Emergency Services Director.
I've never had one under a home that someone actually fell into accidentally that they didn't even know was there.
Downey was helping her daughter pack up and move from the house. Her death's been ruled accidental.
This is CBS News.
You don't need a job platform. You need a hiring partner. Indeed lets you schedule and conduct virtual interviews all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
Robert Hack Diamonds pays cash for your unwanted gold, silver, and even diamonds. That's right. Robert Hack Diamonds wants to make you an offer on your gold, silver, and diamonds. The process is very simple. No appointment needed. Just come on in, sit down in a nice, relaxed atmosphere, and the staff of Robert Hack Diamonds will evaluate your unwanted gold, silver, and diamonds and make you an offer on the spot. Then you can decide if you want a deal or no deal. Robert Hack Diamonds can also convert your old jewelry into something new or trade in your outdated pieces for something new and exciting. Many people inherit jewelry that might not be your taste, but you are sentimental. Why not have Robert Hack Diamonds take the golden gems and create something for you? So many options at Robert Hack Diamonds. Again, Robert Hack Diamonds pays cash for your unwanted gold, silver, and diamonds. See them in Brookfield just east of Moreland on Greenland Avenue or 76 in Layton, right on the corner in Greenfield. RobertHackDiamonds.com.
He says it's because of large natural gas reserves. Also, winter in Wisconsin is forecasted to be mild. I'm Nate Wuggehout, Civic Media News.
The Badgers with a win at home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. In college hoops, Wisconsin with a win in Madison, 71-49 over Western Illinois at 5-2. How's Wisconsin doing so far? Head coach Greg Gard.
I think we're getting there. I think we're a little more consistent, especially on the defensive end. I thought we were decent defensively tonight. It was the offensive rhythm that we just couldn't get a rhythm.
NFL, the Bears beat the Vikings without scoring a touchdown. Chicago winning 12-10. In Green Bay, the Packers getting ready to host the Chiefs. Jordan Love got his first start against them his rookie season. When Aaron Rodgers tested positive for COVID, Green Bay lost 13-7. Matt LaFleur.
It was one of those deals where we came in, I think on Wednesday morning, we found out Aaron was going to be out and Jordan was going to be in. And we should have, instead of just riding with what we game planned, but we should have had a better plan in place for some of the potential issues that were going to come up.
With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. 14 tonight, under partly cloudy skies, southwesterly winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. High of 38 tomorrow, 27 tomorrow night, partly cloudy. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 14 degrees.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw.
540 AM and 101.1 FM. WAUK.
Ever will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I talk a lot about workers' rights and the idea of organizing for better wages, hours, conditions. I say that quite often, but also throw in their opportunities. And I've been saying that the old frame of wages, hours, conditions, that just rolls off the tongue. But I throw more in that because I think we're in a moment right now where organized labor needs to be that fighting force that creates that opportunity for working people, be it through education, be it through healthcare, be it through where you live. Can you afford a house? And the question that has come up is affordable housing the new battlefront for workers' rights? And here to help answer that question is the reporter who asked the question, wrote the article for our good folks over at Capital in Maine, Vanessa Wong. Vanessa, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, this is a topic that, you know, I've talked about, you know, for some time. This idea, yeah, wages, hours, conditions, certainly, but opportunities and housing being a huge part of that, because we're being priced out of being able to buy homes. And it's gotten to the point now where you have these huge hedge funds who are buying up all the rentals. We can't rent homes anymore. So where do we live? And I love the fact that this is now a workers' rights issue.
Yeah, I mean, it was really surprising to me. I spoke with unions around the country who are advocating for affordable housing, either at the bargaining table or outside of the bargaining table. So they're using their platform to either negotiate with their employers for, I mean, wages is one thing, right? But to specifically ask for affordable housing solutions as part of their contract, and also using their platform to do some political advocacy to push for regulation of the housing market so that all of the progress that they make with their contracts and wages aren't immediately eroded by increases in housing prices, which is what we've seen for, I mean, at least
decades.
Decades. I mean, it's in my adult life, that's been the story of the economy. You know, you get a raise and your housing costs. I live in New York City. Your rent goes up, you know, at least whatever your raise was. These days, inflation is eating into people's earnings so much. So it just really feels like no matter how much your wages go up, you know, through the work of the hard work of a lot of union negotiation, there's sort of like no progress in anyone's quality of life. And I think that's why people, I have seen so many surveys recently about people feeling kind of gloomy about it.
Yeah, no, just yesterday we talked about the Wall Street Journal survey that said, you know, that people don't believe that the American dream is possible. That phrase that I grew up believing, if you work hard, you play by the rules, that you get ahead. And sadly, that's not happening. And, you know, the first time I saw this be, you know, the housing issue be part of a union contract fight, I think it was with Google, I think if I'm not mistaken, where the bus drivers and folks were like, hey, we have to sleep in the buses. We have nowhere to live. We can't live in San Francisco on the pittance that we're being paid here. And this is, for me, I look at this as a moment for opportunity for policymakers to get involved and to do something. And I think back to, you know, my grandparents' generation. When my grandparents came, my grandfather came back from World War II, we had a policy in this country to build, you know, good, solid, low-cost housing for those soldiers and their families to live in. You know, we planned Levitt towns all across this country. I don't know why we're not doing that right now, given the fact that housing is so completely outpriced and hedge funds are buying up all the rentals.
Right. I mean, yeah, it was very interesting to learn about the history of union work on affordable housing issues. In New York City, there was a lot of union-developed affordable housing, actually, in the earlier part of the 20th century. Back then, there were union banks that were able to, you know, provide financing for these projects. There was a lot of political interest in this issue, largely as a result of, I think, like housing quality. You know, I think in New York City, there was a big push to build quality housing for people where living conditions weren't good for many. And we saw many thousands of units of affordable housing built over, you know, that early part of the 20th century. And it later just became something that the government and the private market took over afterwards. And I think we've seen where that's gone.
This is where I completely agree with the idea of a public-private partnership. Sadly, what's happened, you know, my grandparents' era public-private partnership was we use public money to get private firms to do things in the public's interest that benefit we the people. What that has morphed into is we use public dollars to enrich private interests for the goal of enriching private interests. And then we the people, we the working folks, we just get stiffed.
That's right. I mean, it was interesting to talk with, you know, Local 26 out in Minnesota about how they, you know, one of the main issues they have with some of these partnerships, the way that their local government is dealing with affordable housing is flawed because the definition of what's affordable is really out of reach for the typical working class person these days. I think in many markets, there's a federal definition. I think it's adopted in a lot of programs of, you know, 30%, right. As long as your income is your housing cost is about 30% of your income. That's the threshold for what's considered affordable. But it's really not. I mean, that's, you know, just having a standard like that doesn't really make sense across the board. 30% of, you know, minimum wage income is really different than 30% of an upper middle class income or, you know, a wealthy person's income. So I just think that, you know, there needs to be more thought about what's going on with a lot of the affordable housing programs that local governments are putting in place because they're not working.
No, this is, you know,
it's indisputable at this point that it's not working.
Yeah, in fact, I was just having this conversation today with one of the station managers, one of our affiliates, and he was saying, you know, I got this great idea on how we can solve all these problems. And granted, it was something that I had talked about years ago and we, you know, we'd gone through. But you go into some of these major cities where you have blight and you have you know, abandoned factories and you have all this stuff, and you just bulldoze all of that and start building from scratch, give people jobs, invest in those communities, give people local ownership to where they can start to build some wealth. We could recreate that prosperous working class of the 50s and 60s if we chose to. The problem is policymakers haven't chosen to do this. We've chosen to give tax breaks to rich people so that they can hoard more and control more instead of making sure that, you know, my kids have an opportunity to do at least as well as I've done.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was an interesting pilot program. I shouldn't even call it a pilot program, but there was an interesting partnership that the AFT did out in West Virginia, where they developed about 20 units of workforce housing for teachers as part of an economic development program. I think what that city found that was that a lot of teachers, you know, weren't coming to teach at the schools because housing was an issue.
Right.
And it was a challenge. That program was a challenge. You know, I mean, I think it was hard to find funding for something like that. And what Randy Weingarten was telling me was that, you know, what happens is you can't, if you're trying to build affordable housing right now, it's really hard because whatever the costs are, you can't push onto the teachers that you're trying to build affordable housing for, right? So like the funding is a really critical issue that I think needs to be dealt with because if, you know, there's no unions can't really be the financier of last resort for right. for
no this thousands. Is where government this is where government has to step in and do this. This is where having higher tax rates on rich people and redistributive policies to ensure that we do have a floor under working people's feet. You know, I ask the question all the time, Vanessa, you know, is, you know, what good's an economy if a large percentage of our people are struggling just for the basic necessities, and government should be that you know, that vehicle that ensures that everyone has at least that opportunity to work hard, play by the rules, and yes, get ahead.
Yeah. I mean, this is an issue. Affordable housing is an issue that's come up on local ballots for years now. I don't know how it's not everyone's top issue at this point. I mean, the median, the average renter in the U.S. is paying about 30% of their rent for housing right now. That means the average renter, just like your average renter, not even in, you know, a big coastal city, is housing cost burden at this point. This is a major political issue. I don't think that, you know, the market alone is going to deal with it. So I'm just surprised that it hasn't become a bigger issue for, you know.
That's because we don't have a mainstream corporate controlled media who finds this interesting. This is taking from their bottom line. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Vanessa Wong. She's a reporter. She wrote this most recent piece, Is Affordable Housing a New Worker's Right? You can check that out over at Capital in Maine. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. And look, I go back to, I think this is something that you're right. I don't know why it isn't something that people are upset about and angry about. I think it has to do with, I'm okay, I'm getting by, somebody else might get something that I'm not. Because that's how we destroy things. That's how we pit people against each other in this country. You know, someone might get something you don't get, Vanessa. So we can't have that, can we?
Right. But, you know, I mean, like, healthcare is such a big political issue right now. It just seems to me that, like, in terms of, like, the share of anyone's wallet, every single month, like, what are you spending your money on? Housing is gigantic, you know? So we'll see. I mean, you know, until then, I guess, like, the unions will continue to sort of drum up some noise about how this issue is impacting their members, because, you know, I think that, you know, over and over again, I just heard that, like, they can't make progress for their members if all of their improvements are just going to go towards a landlord.
No, just, you know, provisions, you know, your housing, your food, your health insurance. You know, what good is a raise if all of it just gets evaporated and you're paying rich people just to exist? Look, we have folks from the Patriotic Millionaires all the time. And the guy goes, I get rich by you making your payments. And he's not wrong. And this is, again, where I come back to, you know, if we had a true free market where, you know, the capitalist principles work, there would be some industrious contractors out there going, hey, there's a market for the kind of homes that my grandparents' generation built. Look, you know, little bungalows, about 1,200 square feet, solid homes that are going to last for another 100 years probably, but we're cheap. You know, helped raise families. My grandparents paid, I think, like 15, 16 grand in the mid 60s. And by the middle 70s, their mortgage was a day's pay. That's never going to happen in our lifetimes. And it's because that it was heavily subsidized on the front end. And because of the stagflation of the 70s, their raises went up because they had strong unions to say, hey, we're not going to allow your standard of living to go down because inflation has eroded it. You know, 75, I think my grandfather got three raises because of the COLA in his contract. That's what we need to be talking about in this day and age.
Right. Oh, my goodness. If only we could all just build a time machine and go back to the 60s. What a dream.
Well, no, it's we hadn't been sold on outrage media. We hadn't been sold on hooray for me. I'm the individual and the heck with everybody else. We hadn't been sold on the things that I grew up with. You know, the one who dies with the most toys wins. You know, that kind of mentality. Greed is good. You know, they didn't think that way to the extreme. Now, granted, they were greedy and granted they wanted stuff, but they had an economy that was based on, hey, how do we help people? And I think we need to be talking about going back to that. And maybe we need another Great Depression. Maybe we need another painful event like they went through. I don't know, but we need to be talking about the policies that made that generation the most prosperous working class in history.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we've been through so many painful events, you know, maybe not to the at the same level of intensity as the Great Depression, but I don't know, so little progress has come out of any of it. And I do feel sometimes like 2023 at this point is just like a worse version of 2019. You know, in other words, the pandemic, I don't feel that the pandemic has any long-term improvement on the situation of Americans, right? So
no.
It's just astounding to me that we all experienced this, you know, like unprecedented, I think that was the word that was repeated over and over again through the first year of COVID, unprecedented event. And we decided to just sort of like go back to the way things were before, but like just a little bit worse.
Just worse. And that's the thing that gets me, Vanessa. I've said the same thing, that, you know, we came out of this event and instead of going, hey, we need to pull together, we need to work less, we need to love more, we need to, you know, spend more time with family, we need to do the better things in life. No, we went right back to let's rip each other to shreds. You know, I say all the time, we should be fighting for things that make our lives better instead of fighting over stuff that tears us apart and is nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
So last question I've got for you, because, you know, clearly something needs to be done. I'm sure you see the same reports that I see, that hedge funds are buying up, you know, all the rental properties. You've got, you know, athletes who've got 100,000 homes that they're renting out to people. How do we push policymakers to move in a direction? I know you didn't really go into this in the article, but, you know, is there any thoughts of, you know, maybe how we come back together, how we push for something like this, or is it really just hopeless?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I hope it's not hopeless, but, you know, I think that I think we've seen people start to mobilize around this, right? The unions are mobilizing. I think, you know, we've seen it on ballots. There were rent strikes through the pandemic. It's just, there's a lot of different things going on. It's just not clear to me yet what it's all going to add up to. It's no mystery right now that housing's not affordable. Like, I just don't think anybody can really make the case that things are okay the way they are. But I think, like, there needs to be more clarity and more, I guess, a more collective understanding that this is an issue that needs, like, to be addressed urgently.
Yeah. No, the failure of our policymakers is sometimes stunning to me. But I look at the system that we have is meant to be this kind of chaos where nothing really gets done. And the status quo is really great for the wealthy because they can continue to rob us blind. But excellent piece. I hope folks will take a look at it. The article is Affordable Housing, A New Worker's Right, written by Vanessa Wong. We'll get links out on how you can check the article out over at Cap and Main. Vanessa, I appreciate you taking time for it. Love to have you back again soon.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much. I want to hear your thoughts. Is this where we should be battling? Is this something we should be fighting for? I want to hear it. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, it really is quite remarkable when you stop and think about it. The fact that you go back to the end of World War II and the policies that came out, the idea that we were going to use tax dollars to build communities for people to live in, that we built swimming pools and parks, and we built all kinds of things that were for the good of we the people. We built the commons. Wasn't for profit, wasn't for special interest. It was for people to lead lives, to raise families. Now you could go, well, you know, but, you know, Rick, you know, and there's always the caveats. It wasn't this way for everybody. And I, absolutely, I'm with you. We can learn from that era and we can make right the things that weren't righted. And there's part of me goes, that's kind of the reason that I don't think we get these things done. We could be building, you know, the same kind of communities that my grandparents grew up in. In fact, you know, I was talking to one of the station managers today of one of our affiliates, and he said, you know, like Baltimore. He goes, you go into parts of Baltimore and it's all blight. It's all, you know, abandoned buildings. It's all problems. It's all chaos. Why can't we take the money that we've, allocated to do certain programs in those areas and just tear it all down? Tear those blighted, dilapidated buildings down and build new housing that, you know, gives people jobs in those communities to build those houses so that they have, you know, ownership of it. And it's not that you have, you know, some slumlord who then owns this new development. No, you get the people to build their communities. You give them jobs. You create that economy right there. And then, you know, when you build it, they will come. And it's not a bad idea. It's something that I've talked about before. You go into places, people need jobs. All I hear from my conservative friends is, you know, you go into Baltimore, you go into Chicago, and it's nothing but crime. It's the murder capitals of the world. You go, no, not all places. You go into any city across this country, I'm sure you're going to find trouble. And those, oddly enough, are places where you have high poverty. How about we address that by creating jobs? I have never been a handout guy. I've never been someone who believes that, you know, we just give money out. I believe in jobs. I believe in union jobs. And I also believe that government should be the employer of last resort. If private corporations won't, they say they can't, but I say they won't create enough jobs for everyone, the private sector has to. Because I do believe there's dignity in work. I do believe there are, you know, people who need jobs. Instead of what we've been doing, which is creating an economy where the handful do very well and, well, the working folks get stiffed. And housing has been one of those areas. Look, you know, my wife and I were just talking about this today. We're, you know, talking about, you know, what we're going to do when we retire a number of years down the road. You know, what we're going to do with our house and, you know, can we move and all this stuff. And I'm going, you know, our mortgage rates are cheap right now. We'd be stupid to move because other houses that you're going to have to buy, and all, it's crazy. Now, is there going to be a correction? Sure, there's going to be a correction down the road. But I think that only comes when you start saying, hey, we do need to build more housing, especially on the lower end. I don't know who can afford these $300,000-$500,000 homes. I don't know. Especially in you know, places that aren't major cities. But you I had someone, you know, in California tell me that, you know, $1 million is the cost of a home in a lot of places. And I'm going, who can afford that? What working person can afford that? And the sad reality is, as was pointed out to me, this is how you end up having multiple generations living in the same home. This is how you have, you know, these other scenarios. And I think we can do better. I think as working people, as voters, as citizens, shouldn't we be demanding better out of our legislatures? And what are we getting out of the Republicans in Congress? Because here's the thing, you know, if I suggest this to a conservative, a Republican, one of the red hats, they're going to scream socialism. Without thinking about the fact that this is stuff that we did to build the prosperity of a generation. My grandparents, when they got married, and they got married for the old-fashioned reason, they had to. In fact, you know, my aunt was, born 4 months into the wedding, because the first one always comes whenever. Everyone after that's 9 months. But they were homeless. They were literally living in their car. And throughout their lives of my, just my grandfather working for, you know, a good 15, 10, 12 years, they were able to buy a couple of homes. They were able to live with dignity and respect. They were able to have a pension and Social Security and savings. And they led a dignified life.
This is the Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. Nearly all of the captives released by Israel and Hamas have been women and children. Mediators are in Qatar trying to extend the ceasefire. CBS's Lilia Luciano.
So far, the initial deal that was for a four-day, I'm not going to call it a truce, but a temporary truce in exchange for 50 hostages. The whole time, it included women and children.
Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter's memorial service was held today with her husband in attendance. Her son, James, said the Rosalynn's dementia, she talked about how she liked living in Hawaii.
She got up from the sofa, pushed her walker away, which she couldn't take a step without, and proceeded to do the hula for 2 or 3 minutes.
Lawmakers could vote this week on whether to remove embattled Representative George Santos from Congress. Santos insists.
I ask that all my colleagues in the House consider and understand what this means for the future. And to set the record straight and put this in the record, I will not be resigning.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
For Civic Media News, I'm Nate Wegehow. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. A bill that would automatically update parents on what their child has checked out from the library got a public hearing today. Under the Republican-authored bill, all books checked out in either a public library or school library would be sent to parents. Emily Dittmar is with the Wisconsin Educational Media and Technology Association and a school librarian in Muskego.
With school libraries so understaffed, dedicating so much time to administrative tasks takes the certified librarians away from student interactions.
Dittmar adds that students' checkout history is already available to parents by request. People in Wisconsin feeling generous this time of year are urged to be careful when donating to charity. It's Charity Fraud Awareness Week. Consumer protection officials say you should ask solicitors for their names, addresses, and phone numbers. You should also ask how much of your donation will be used to actually help people. I'm Nate Wegehout, Civic Media News.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. 14 tonight, under partly cloudy skies, southwesterly winds 10 to 15 miles an hour. High of 38 tomorrow, 27 tomorrow night, partly cloudy. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 16 degrees.
The Green Bay Packers call Lambeau Field home, but did you know the stadium has a history all its own? It started with where to build it. Residents on both sides of the city wanted it. Officials argued there had to be room for growth. Eventually, farmland was purchased, but in Ashwaubenon. The bargaining continued, and in 1956, the land was annexed to Green Bay. Green Bay City Stadium became a reality the following year and was renamed in honor of team co-founder and coach Curly Lambeau in 1965. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Your home of the Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
Some Hightower saying, these attacks are silly because they are silly, and also because they're attacking the future. To work for yard sanity and choice, go to rewild.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I got to tell you, I'm already looking forward to next Thanksgiving because the turkey and all that stuff was so great. My wife is an incredible cook and always does really, really good stuff on Thanksgiving. But I also love Black Friday. Black Friday was always a day of activism. For years, I was out at the Walmart, doing the Black Friday picketing out there years ago. And now it's all about the Amazon. And you saw a number of actions across the country and across the globe on Black Friday around Amazon and organizing workers in those places. And here to share some thoughts on, how the actions went on Black Friday and, maybe what's in store for the coming year. I've asked Randy Corgan to come talk with us. Randy is the principal officer and secretary treasurer of Teamsters Local 1932 out on the West Coast. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Anytime, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk about Black Friday. Black Friday has become a day of labor activism. In fact, we've seen a lot of places who are saying, we're not going to have our people working on Black Friday. We'll have these online deals. So the pressure is working in some places, but what's going on at Amazon?
Well, as you can see, I'm sure everybody's been paying attention to the activism all over the world, not just the country. You have locations as far away as the UK, Australia, a number of places that not just you had actions, you have had activity on the floor within the operations, and you obviously had strikes. You had extension of pickets. You had workers walk off the job in a number of areas, North Carolina, the United Kingdom, New Jersey, Georgia, Los Angeles, San Bernardino, Mariloma, literally all over the place. Workers are just basically taking direct action. And I think the wrap on Amazon is everyone's kind of figuring it out. It's getting more and more obvious. It's getting, and it's funny to see their response all the time. We create great jobs and we're great to these communities. And I guess they keep saying it, they can't believe their own BS. And if they create such great jobs, why do they have such crazy turnover? If the job is so great, why is there 150% turnover in less than a year?
No, and look, I say this all the time. I worked for a company called Roadway Express for 20 years. And one of the things that they used to talk about is they were very proud to have a unionized workforce because they had a 2% turnover rate. And they said, look, people come here, they make careers here, they stay here, we train them, they're the best trained workers in the workforce, and they were proud of that. The fact that you have a major corporation in this country who has 150% turnover, that's a failure. That's what a failure looks like, Randy.
The days of an employer saying, come to work for me, you can come to work here, we're going to pay you the best, you're going to be able to retire here. We have the best retirement program, the best healthcare plans. We have, they would tout themselves as the best employer, and you can ultimately work your, they wanted to get somebody at 18, 19, 20 years old, soon as they entered the workforce, and keep them as long as possible. That is the complete opposite of Amazon's business model. And what I love seeing is these workers that are taking direct action all over the country. You see them, it's their face on the picket line. It's not mine. I'm the director of division. I have a little bit to do with some of these actions all over the country. But we're making sure that those workers are the face of it. Those workers are explaining their reason for taking direct action. Those workers are telling the general public why they're taking on this business model and why this business model is so destructive. It's funny to see Amazon even claim they're great to small business. They're crushing small business. It's one of those things, you keep saying it, I guess you'll believe it. I'd love to see how they're great for some small businesses, but I can point to many, many of them that they're crushing every single day. Well, small businesses aren't around to point it out.
Yeah, they're good for small businesses in that they put them out of business quickly. They kill them quickly. They don't let them linger long term.
Yeah, there's not a lot of misery.
Right, it's quick. Because look, they are this behemoth that is dominating this market right now, And if legislatively we're not going to do anything, it's got to be the working people who stand up and take and are empowered to do what they're doing. And this is why I do have some faith. I think we're in a moment right now where people have finally said, you know, enough is enough, and are taking some empowerment, are taking some actions. One of the things that I've talked about for years is, you know, when people go, "Wow, the union," I go, "No, not the union, your union, our union, not the, your, our." Engage with it, own it. And I think this generation's kind of grabbing onto that. Or do you disagree?
I totally agree. More than 70% of workers in America support unions. The younger generation supports it over 80%. And it's because of these very things that you're talking about. You mentioned something I got to comment on. You know, legislatively, are they going to be able to deal with it? No. Like even if they create some policy, it doesn't do any good unless the workers took direct action to create the policy. The reality is everything in this country that has value for workers has got to be driven by workers that took action to demand a policy change in conjunction with it, not that a bunch of people sitting around think what's best for these workers. Workers at Amazon are taking action, and it is growing by the day. Last year, there was a little bit of activity. Throughout the year, you're seeing ongoing activities, you're seeing extension of pickets, you're seeing workers walk off the job. We're seeing hundreds of workers almost weekly walk off the job over and over and over again. Of course, Amazon's not gonna talk about it. You know, you can't keep a lot of press on this all the time. That's okay. Everybody's not looking to change the world in a minute. The reality is as time goes on, more and more workers are realizing the place in which they're going to have control and power is worker power. As you put it, their union, they're going to take control of these situations. And at the end of the day, they're going to say, "Hey, Amazon, you need to do a little bit better with your business model. This business model is trash. It is junk."
Yeah, no, I say all the time, it's about wages, hours, conditions, but also opportunities. You know, and just, you know, the last segment, we were talking with a reporter who wrote a piece on, you know, asking the question, is affordable housing a worker's right? And, you know, all of this stuff, you know, comes back to empowering a generation of working people to use the tools at their disposal to make their lives better, whether it is their union or their government, to be pushing for policies. The hope is in both directions, like my grandparents' generation did, but at least we're beginning those organizing opportunities. We're bringing people together. That gives me hope for the future.
And the other place that it's happening, Rick, is it's happening at city councils. It's happening at county board of supervisor meetings. It's happening in municipal sort of settings where there's people are recognizing that their civic responsibility, that quite frankly they abandoned for quite some time, that their civic responsibility, that platform is a space in which workers can demand those elected officials on a local level impact their everyday too. Like that, not everything is up to Congress. Not everything is up to the Senate. Not everything is up to the President of the United States. Matter of fact, that is where we have failed ourselves, is we put it into that space where it's gotta be the NLRB or it's gotta be the DOL or it's gotta be some huge bureaucracy that takes forever to issue rulings. State agencies, you know, state municipalities, local city government municipalities have the ability to have enforcement. They have the ability to deal with these things. And that's the other thing that we see happening. We see workers, residents, and community taking control of this, joining together on picket lines, saying enough is enough with this business model. Yeah, Amazon's huge. It's big. This stuff doesn't happen overnight. It takes one person at a time.
Yeah. As I say, you want to change the world? Start by your little corner of it. And that's exactly what you're talking about here. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Randy Corrigan. Randy's the principal officer and secretary treasurer of Teamsters Local 1932. Their website, teamsters1932.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that and the work that they do. And if you're an Amazon worker and you want to find out more information on how to get involved, how to get active, how to maybe bring the union message to your little piece of the world, I'm sure Randy would be more than happy to help you. So you'll walk me through that. I mean, because clearly I know you're getting calls every day from people going, "Hey, I saw this. I want to make this better." You know, walk me through what that process looks like for an Amazon worker.
Well, let me back up to you asked a couple of things. What's it look like? First of all, last week, 117 people said, hey, we need to deal with this, right? Like 117 came in. Like, what's happened, there is literally thousands of workers that are reaching out. And, you know, obviously it takes time. These are massive operations. You got to make sure that this stuff is coordinated in the right way. So what does it look like for somebody who's listening in and who's paying attention? First thing you got to do, you can reach out to the division. You can reach out to my website personally. It doesn't matter. We're going to funnel it all to the same space. I want to make sure wherever you're working in your particular region that you're working with all the community groups as well as the unions that are collectively taking this subject on, and everybody's working together. We're going to make sure that you're working together with the workers in that industry. That, in other words, you and UPSers and freight drivers and grocery workers, everybody that's kind of collectively in the same industry, that you're all collectively putting together a demand on the industry and putting a demand on Amazon to say, you need to bring things up to par. You need to have working conditions. You need to have pay, benefits, and a structure in which matches the industry so that there's somewhat of an industry standard. There's got to be a benchmark here. Can't keep eroding. So what does that look like? First thing you got to do is you got to either pick up the phone, send an email, reach out to your local union. Your local union, Teamster local union in the area. All of those things, we make sure that they're funneled into a common space, and we make sure all the appropriate people that are working on it in that particular region is advancing it. And sometimes people say, oh, well, it's not going to move fast enough. Sometimes it doesn't. It depends. How, you know, you got some areas that got 5, 10, 20. You got 40,000 Amazon workers in the Inland Empire, another 50,000 in the LA base. You got even more in San Diego. So that's a big number in Southern California. Right? You can't move those types of people, you know, with just a snap of the finger. You have to make sure everybody's on board. And the most important thing is, I think the thing that we have all missed, and I love that you say it all the time, Rick, is we got to make sure that the community is alongside with us on this. We got to make sure that community stakeholders, that elected officials and local elected officials and local community organizations are grounded in this work too. Because without that, it won't survive. That they being those community allies, have to partner up with these workers and demand that their community collectively expects more. That way it's not third party is what this union institution is asking. It's a community that's saying we deserve better.
No, and that we earn better. We create this wealth. And this is the part that, you know, when I was doing organizing and talking to workers, it's like, look, you create the wealth for this company. You earn a portion of that. And, you know, the question is, you know, it's you probably should be getting a lot more than you are. And you get that by organizing. And this is where I keep coming back to. Amazon is a massively profitable company. We're talking billions of dollars in money going into the hands of the few. The people who create that wealth, I think, earn a lot more than what they're getting. I think the president has talked about this as well, you know, especially with the UAW folks. So last question I've got for you, because you're seeing these successes, the UAW with the Big Three, the Teamsters with UPS. You're seeing a lot of these contracts going.
Culinary.
Right.
Culinary.
Absolutely. That was incredible. We had folks on from that. What's the message going forward in getting people to go, hey, I can do that?
Well, part of it is seeing this activism of workers. Right. And I think that looking and seeing they look like one another. They're obviously doing very similar work for one another. And there's a slight difference here. So your culinary, your UPS, and your UAW. Those are all contract renewals, right? Which is very different than the space on Amazon.
Right.
The Amazon space is actually building it from the beginning, where
much UAW, like Starbucks.
Yes. Yeah. Those are all, you know, 100-year contracts, 50-year contracts, culinaries, you know, 40-year contracts, right? So there's a system in place where you have automatic expiration. You got triggers and processes that make that take the next step automatically. Talking about workers organizing on this scale, it is, you know, there's things that aren't definitive. It's not like, well, the contract expires on the 30th of November, and you know, and if we don't get a deal, we're going to go on strike. Things aren't clearly written in that space, so they become a little less definitive. But workers actually have more opportunity to take control in that space once they understand worker power and they understand the rules. Unfortunately, workers in the last few decades have been basically convinced that this process is futile. And you just, you know, companies own everything and it's up to them and you got to give up and just move on. And that goes back to our history of slavery and all that. It's another show we should have a long discussion on. But specifically, what's the message for today is that if these workers can do it, you can do it. And if you don't do it, who's going to do it?
Yep.
Because at some point, we got to do it. We've in the transportation industry, we have seen working conditions, wages and benefits plummet because they had a business model, not just Amazon, but what the predecessors of Amazon got away with: temporary workforce, contingent workforce, you know, having everything subcontracted out, every big employer and big corporation escaping their responsibility and dumping it on someone else. Well, what that led to was a degradation in wages, a degradation in benefits as a whole across the board. Now workers are saying, hey, we're not, this is good. These should be good jobs. These shouldn't be transitional jobs. These shouldn't be temporary jobs. And now you're seeing elimination of temporary work. But, you know, workers have got to do more of this. There's not going to be a snap of the finger and go away. It's going to take a lot of years of this activism to push through and for literally millions of workers to push back. I know some people say that sounds crazy when I say that. It's not crazy, Rick. It absolutely has to happen because that is what workers did in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. They moved millions of workers doing exactly what we're talking about right now by taking action in their own hands, withholding their labor and saying, I want a union contract.
No, you're spot on. The old adage, if not you, who? If not now, when? Pretty simple. Randy, I appreciate the time. Love the passion. Hope folks will reach out. Teamsters1932.org, the website. Randy Corrigan, Secretary Treasurer, Principal Officer there at Teamsters Local 1932. Appreciate the time, man. Thanks so much.
Anytime, man. Thanks for having me on.
Our good friend Randy Corrigan. Again, Teamsters1932.org, the website. Make sure you check that out. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1891. That was the day the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union began in St. Louis, Missouri. At the time of the union's founding, the field of electrical work was very new. Linemen often risked their lives for their jobs. They worked on high power lines, sometimes as long as 12 hours a day. They worked in all sorts of weather, typically earning as little as 15 to 20 cents an hour. In 1890, an exposition was held in St. Louis to showcase a glorious display of electrical wonders. The exposition brought together electrical workers from throughout the United States. At the end of their work each day, the men would gather and talk. They shared stories of their hard work under dangerous and unsafe conditions. They decided it was time to form a union. They reached out to the American Federation of Labor. The AFL sent an organizer named Charles Castle to help them. Soon, Local Number 5221 of the Electrical Wiremen and Linemen's Union was established in St. Louis. But the men knew they had to reach beyond St. Louis. They elected lineman Harry Miller as their president. They then sent him traveling by railroad boxcar to cities like Indianapolis, Pittsburgh, New Orleans, and Milwaukee. Miller helped linemen in these cities organize their own local unions. Delegates from 10 locals, representing less than 300 members, gathered in St. Louis. It was there that they drafted a constitution and adopted a logo, the iconic image of a clenched fist holding two lightning bolts. And with that, the IBEW was born. Today, the union represents approximately 250,000 members and is a true spark for the labor movement. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. So, real quick, I want to let everyone know we're ticking down the days until we're turning off the live microphones and leaving, you know, the live radio space. We will be expanding our free speech TV offerings in the new year. We're going to be doing an hour every day. Still working on the time. I think they're talking about 5 o'clock in the afternoon for our live, for our TV show. That will be every day, Monday through Friday. We will be offering the audio to radio stations. So many of the affiliates that you're listening to us on right now are going to grab the hour. So we are not going to go away. We want to have some interactivity. We want people to continue to email and reach out to us. And we're hoping that this is a way forward. We're hoping that this is a way for us to expand our reach, you know, engage with more people and move into the newer technologies. You know, the sad reality is a lot of people believe radio is dead. I don't. I believe radio is, while it may not be the future in 20, 30 years, I believe it is the now. And we most certainly do need to be engaging in this space. But truth be told, you know, we've got to make our revenue fit our what we're doing to reach folks. So TV seems to be the best way forward for us. And I hope you'll check out freespeech.org. That is where we will be spending our time helping promote that. We're going to be doing a lot more social media and the podcast space. You know, I had someone go, you know, hey, Rick, are you still going to do long form interviews? And I said, you know, we're going to do some of that stuff where we're going to, you know, try and do, you know, some in-depth interviews, but that'll be in the podcast space. So you'll want to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss a moment of what we do. And I got people who are, you know, they subscribe, they listen religiously, and I'm thankful for those folks, grateful for the time that they give us. But yeah, that's where we're going. And as always, all this stuff will be at thericksmithshow.com. Ways to find us, ways to engage, you know, ways to interact. That is our hope. So I'm looking forward to the new year, because I think this is going to be a great opportunity to expand our reach. You know, free speech is in, you know, at 80 million homes across the country. And, you know, with the streaming services that are out there, you know, virtually you, no matter where you are, you can grab this. So the talk is, you know, we're going to take this hour and we're going to do the best hour on TV and ultimately on radio. And I'm looking forward to that. It's going to give us some real opportunities. But for all the folks who've been reaching out concerned that they're going to lose us, they're not going to lose us. The RickSmithShow.com is always going to be there for you to reach out and find where we are. I want to finish off with Tommy Tuberville. Now, we talked about Tommy Tuberville the other day, and I believe that part of what he has done and part of the thinking was, if you hold up these promotions long enough in the military, you hold enough back that, you know, Trump becomes president, and then you can do what they did, what McConnell did with judges. Only Tuberville, not as smart as McConnell. Didn't really think through the whole, hey, the optics, not good. The optics are bad because you're supposed to be the party of the military. You're supposed to be the guys who, you know, when you see somebody in your uniform, you run over there and take a selfie with them. You're there for the photo ops. But Tuberville said, he told his colleagues, I got you into this mess. I'm going to get you out. And he evidently went on, you know, talking about the longstanding traditions of the Senate, said he would be, it would be eroded if the Senate Democrats passed the resolution that would allow most of the military promotions to go forward. And I go, no, this is what a functional democracy looks like. When one person throws a temper tantrum, when one person has a fit, when one person is the fly in the ointment, the sand in the Vaseline, whatever you want to frame that is, when one guy's the a-hole, everybody else deals with him. And it's about time Schumer starts looking at dealing with the giant you-know-what. So we'll see where this goes. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Always there, always available. I want to hear your thoughts. Something I said got under your skin, on your nerves. Hey, I want to join a union. I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
Listening to the Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media Network of local radio.